Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth every week at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday and grateful for the time you're giving me. And today we're going to have fun. I'm pleased to welcome into the VOV Gene Boss studio, Gar LaSalle. He is an award-winning author, filmmaker, physician, sculptor, and Vashon Islander. Gar is here to tell us many things, and I want to welcome you, Gar.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, the first question I have for you, though, with all these things that you do, I mean, you're a physician, a sculptor, a filmmaker, a professor, an author, incredibly accomplished and talented. We ordinary folks spend our days cleaning house, cooking, binge-watching, watching TV series, walking our dogs, doing our jobs, or what's left of them. So how do you spend your time these days?
Well, I do all those same things. I have a dog, and I do binge-watching on TV things and that sort of thing. But in between, I try to fit in a variety of things that are of interest to me. And it's attached to the amount of energy that one puts into it and how you set goals for yourself and persist in trying to achieve them. A friend of mine once told me, well, Gar, you don't have ADHD, you know, you have adult.
Is this like a crow adult thing?
Adult deficit. Ushiny disorder. So, ADOS, and I have a lot of interest. I've always loved sculpture, and I love writing, and I kind of set goals, and I kind of go for them and persist until I accomplish them, no matter how long it takes. So
was your first goal to become a physician?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I grew up in a family of opera singers. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my granduncle, my father, and my sister were all opera singers. My sister still has a company called Lyric Opera Northwest, and she teaches here in the Pacific Northwest. But my father advised me when I was a young man, even though I loved watching him up on the stage when I was a kid, a little boy, and I have pretty vivid memories of him in his costumes and all of that. He said, look, you know, the vicissitudes of a performing career in particular and the arts are very difficult and there's no guarantees. So get a good day job, find a profession. So that you can support yourself and create some balance in your life. In so many words, that's essentially what he told me. And so when I was in college, I had a dual major. I had a biology major in pre-med when I was at Reed College, and I was also a theater major. and I produced and directed and acted in a lot of plays, and there's some incredible stories attached to trying to juggle those things. And then came the time when I was graduating and I had the option of either going to drama graduate school in directing at Yale or going to Cornell Medical College in New York. And I talked to a good physician friend. He said, hey, you know, you can always go back to the arts later on, but you may not be able to have the opportunity to be a physician if you pass this up. And so I chose the latter, and by the time I finished medical school and got my license, I knew that I also wanted to fulfill the other side of my thing. So that's when I went to CalArts, did my master's in filmmaking there, and learned about screenwriting.
And I understand George Clooney owes you a vote of thanks because Michael Crichton credits your documentary film as the inspiration for his series ER.
Yeah, that's a funny story. Michael Crichton was a physician, but he never practiced medicine. And I had, as my thesis, at Cal Arts the opportunity to film myself with a film crew when I was working as an emergency physician in East Los Angeles. So we did a documentary called Diary of a Moonlighter, four parts, 24-hour shift, full code, full arrest, overdoses, and lacerations were the sections. It played on PBS for about 3 years in a series they call POV, or Point of View. And Crichton saw it and later conveyed to me that he was kind of impressed with the whole notion of all the stories that I had woven into it, and the fact that, you know, it's a rich, fertile grounds for doing something. So 9 years later, he finally was able to get his pitch through, and that's where ER came from. And coincidentally, they contacted me and wanted me to be one of their script advisors when the series was really taking off. But at the same time, I was pretty heavily involved back up here in the Northwest again, doing administrative medicine. And so I couldn't go back down to Los Angeles. But yeah, long story. But
yeah, but you managed to find time then to start writing this series of books. And it starts with Widow Walk, which I had the pleasure of reading. I have so many questions about that. One of them kind of refers to your experience as an emergency medicine or medicine physician, in that you describe the processes of dying in a couple of chapters in this book in some incredible detail. Was your intimacy with death in the emergency room helpful in that regard?
Oh, absolutely. In a very personal way. And in particular, early on when I was working in the ER, if you go to the old film Diary of a Moonlighter, you'll see an interview that a fellow by the name of Jim Hart was asking the question. He later became a producer for the Hill Street Blues and for couple other medical shows, but he was the second camera on that documentary, and he asked me, you know, how do you deal with death? Because we had just filmed a full code, and I think it was the first time we ever showed a person dying on film in front of you while we were.
Is that even legal or accepted in the film industry?
It was legal, but and we had consents from everybody, and from the family, but it hadn't been done before.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to include it. And so he asked me, you know, how do you deal with death? And at that time, I was still pretty close to the street, as they say, in terms of identifying with the patient, patients that I was taking care of, and struggling with the whole notion of the responsibility of caring for a patient and then losing a patient. And so I struggled through with all of that, and then watching people pass away, people within your own family and all of that. Yeah. And so I believe that I can speak to that pretty directly in a way where I don't have to make up things. Let's just put it that way.
Well, in reading the book Widow Walk, it really brought me, the reader, into that experience. And would you tell our listeners, if you can, a little summary of Widow Walk and even the two subsequent books that followed? It's
sure.
In the Pacific Northwest with a female protagonist. I want to ask you about that. Mm-hmm. But tell us a bit about the stories.
Well, again, this story was inspired by my experience. I in medical school during the summer, I had opportunity to work on a salmon fishing boat, and I got to fish with a lot of Lummi natives from up in the Bellingham area. And they told me a story that I had never heard before about a group of people they call the Northerners. Nobody really knew who they were. They were our version of the Vikings, so to speak. They were probably hodgepodge of different tribes, masters of the tides, and they would sweep down out of the fog and attack native tribes, and they were marauders and slavers and headhunters. And there are stories of them doing their raids all the way as far south as Mendocino, California.
Wow.
But at any rate, I was working in the local ER on Whidbey Island because we had a contract up there. The company that I used to manage still does that ER. And a mile away from that hospital ER was something called the Eby Plateau. And I heard the story about Isaac Eby and what had happened to him. And this is 1857, when there were only 3,000 non-native people in the whole Pacific Northwest.
Which, when you think about it, is kind of late in American history.
Yes, it is. Little known history. If you go up to Whidbey, there's a lot of people who don't even know this story. But predating that, 6 months before, their American gunboat had fired on a group of Salish people who were gathered around a sawmill in Port Gamble, and they managed to kill a northerner Tyee chieftain. And 6 months later, in the middle of the night, they came down and were looking for a white Tyee in revenge. And Isaac Eby happened to be in the way. They killed him. They took his head, paraded it up the coast, showing it off. And it took the family years to get that head back, or what was left of it, face mask, and you know all of that. So that became the nidus of a story. Widowak came out of that. I wrote a treatment for it, and as I said, I brought it to Nick Kazan and he recommended I write a book. And when I was getting ready to retire from my administrative clinical duties as an emergency physician, I sat down in earnest and completed the research. And I had already mapped out the story and done all that. And I put flesh on it, so to speak, with a lot of personal material. So I wanted to tell a story about a very strong protagonist woman and her young family, and what one is faced with in the face of tragedy when you don't have the help of people that you would expect to have help from. And in this story, she gets no help from the local military or from the British. And she eventually, I'm not going to spoil the story, so that was the first book. But as it turned out, it won a lot of awards. I was pretty excited about that. The Eric Hoffer Award for best new novel and that sort of thing. That was going to be it. And then people said, hey, you know, you've got a durable character here, and what's going to happen? So that's when I said to sit down and write the second book. And I discovered that during that time, there was a brand new railroad going across the Isthmus of Panama, the most expensive way of travel in the world. $25 in gold per person and $3 in gold per pound of baggage, which included human cargo, by the way, such as slaves. And I discovered about the Isthmus jungle and the Darieni, who were the robbers, the gold robbers, and that's where the second story evolved. And then the third book takes her back and her what's left of her family back to Boston, and right during the Civil War, the first couple of years of the Civil War. So I started exploring that and went down to Richmond and into Washington, D.C., and National Archives, and a number of different sources for that, and told the third story. And the fourth story is that I've done the research for now, and I'm in the process of writing, is also during the Civil War, and it goes through the Midwest with the same family, and will involve events that occurred in Kansas and Missouri, and will culminate with the Quantrell raid that happened in Lawrence, Kansas in 1863, right after Gettysburg. The fifth book will take place back here in the Northwest, and it will finish the entire saga, I hope. Because I need to get on and write something else now.
Well, it sounds like the research process has been a lot of fun.
It is. It is a lot of fun. I spent a lot of time walking through the battlefields, of course, looking around the Northwest. I live here in Vashon, so it was not difficult to envision what happened. and this is based on interviews with locals who tell stories about dealing with the Northerners. And there are local stories. Every tribe has a story about how they dealt with the Northerners. And what happened here in Vashon is that I reenacted in the book is kind of an expansion on a story I heard about how they dealt with them.
Well, and I was curious about that as I was reading the book, because I know there's a lot of pseudo history, if you will, of natives in the Pacific Northwest. So what was your most reliable source for genuine history?
Well, lots of reading in books, interviewing old people, but there's not a lot of written native history, unfortunately. Yeah. So it's all, you know, essentially word of mouth and the confabulations that occur that are blended in with the native myth, et cetera, and lots of books based in Vancouver and the British dealings with the native tribes, and interviewed a fellow named David Berge, who just last year finished the most important book about Chief Seattle that has come out.
Wow.
And all of that. So, yeah, I got a lot of verbal information and then a lot of research and put it together from there.
So I'm curious about so much, but about your choice of a female protagonist, a strong woman, mm-hmm. throughout all now five of these books, I presume.
Yeah.
She is Emmy.
Right.
And I'm curious about that choice for you. And how do you respond to folks who say, how can a man write about a woman's head?
Well, the lucky thing for me is that I've had the opportunity to work with some very, very, very talented, strong, steel backbone women in my career. I happen to be married to one who is just like that. So the Emmy character is an amalgam of all of those very admirable women. And I try to put it back in Victorian times when women were not only second-class citizens, they had no rights whatsoever. And I want this saga to be a story about the evolution in our minds, about human emancipation, so to speak. Not only the Africans who were enslaved, it's the Native Americans who were taken advantage of, and it's the women in particular. So that's what I really want. But our minds evolve in terms of our acceptance of all of that. And the story is set in a time when Victorian age, when women were expected to behave a certain way, and it took someone a strong, I guess you'd call it, integrity and character to be able to do the right thing. That's who Emmy is.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when she's going to be fragile, but there are also times when she is going to absolutely summon things that she is not even aware that she has. And the precipitant to all of this in the first book, at least, is when everything is torn away from her.
Mm-hmm.
Her second husband, who's murdered, her kidnapped child, she plumbs her depths, so to speak, and does what she needs to do in order to preserve her family, which I think is the epitome of what womanhood is really all about in so many different ways. And I really admire that. So that's who Emmy is.
She is a very admirable character.
Thank you.
And As I'm reading your book, I'm thinking about when a person writes, a lot of authors say that the story begins to take on a life of its own and tells itself. Yours is based on actual events and real people. So does it take on a life of its own? Did it take on a life of its own as you were telling the story? Or did you have to stay with what you knew to be the true events? How do you mesh those two?
It's a very good question in particular for anybody who's trying to write historical fiction. I believe that you not only have to have the dates and the events down, but you also try to have to scratch down really hard on some of the true characters to try to understand what their psyche was. And then, of course, we don't know what they really said. So you put this person together with this person. Maybe both of them are true life people. Some of them, one person might be an invented character from that standpoint. But the motivations if they are plausible, will drive the dialogue. And when you're doing screenwriting, there's a process. We used to call it postcarding, and where you start with fade in and the second card is fade out, and then everything in between. And as you're going through your rough plot, you start discovering characters and what I would call foils, people whose actions and words reflect back on the main characters and the action from that standpoint. And yes, the story, if you have the general outline and it's plausible, then your characters are being consistent with what you have developed for them in terms of their motivations, then it becomes easier. But it's still difficult.
To put yourself in that place and then let it take off. Right. So you are now pitching this series of stories as a TV series.
Right.
Now, one of the things I noticed when I was reading is that there's a lot of internal dialogue going on in your characters. How are you going to translate that into the action and the dialogue that has to happen in a visual medium?
That's a real, real good question. The screenwriting teacher that I had at CalArts was a fellow named Alexander McKendrick, very accomplished filmmaker. People who are film buffs know, you know, The Man in the White Suit and Lady Killers and all the other things like that. And he cautioned us repeatedly to be terse in terms of the dialogue and everything else like that, and let the situation define really what's going on inside of their heads from that standpoint. So I don't need to say, have Emmy say, gee, I'm thinking this and that or whatever else from that standpoint. I don't know. Her actions will speak much more loudly than any dialogue that I can possibly create. The motivations have to be there so that anybody who's looking at it would say, what would this person, what would I do in this circumstance? Mm-hmm. And what do I know about this person? And how will she or he behave in this particular circumstance? And then you pepper in their little surprises as well in order to keep the interest going. You talk about the pitch process. That's been a fascinating thing. So far, I've written the pilot screenplay and the second episode screenplay. We've written a 25-page treatment for it. I have a producer partner down in Los Angeles who's doing the actual physical pitching right now, something called a lookbook, something called the pitch deck. Now we're creating something called a sizzle teaser. When I was working with Tom Skerritt, we did a whole series of teasers as well. And all of that gets packaged, and you have to whet the appetite of whoever you're putting it in front with, hopefully with a good sizzle, and then to get them to start reading and looking, because they don't have a lot of time to do reading. So far, it's been on front of Leonardo DiCaprio. They passed on it, in quotes, for now, in quotes, but they like the story very much. It is sitting on the desk in front of the production companies for Kevin Costner and Renee Zellweger. Elizabeth Olsen's production company loved it, but she just finished a TV series, so she wants to do a movie next. And there's a local Native American actor who's been in several films recently who is also looking at that, and he would play the role, the very pivotal role of Jojo, who is, mm-hmm. I think, he's the Native guide who is a couple of different reviewers have said he is the moral compass of the story.
Yeah.
So hopefully he's tied up doing the story of Jim Thorpe right now. But he's, I think we're going to, I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Right. It sounds like an arduous process.
It is.
I'm wondering, given that there are so many streaming platforms emerging now, it seems to me there would be a huge demand for content. Yeah. Are you finding that these pitches are a little more welcome?
Well, the whole business has been stalled because of COVID. So all of the production stopped down in Los Angeles. They're starting up again slowly. But people then during that downtime started writing. So there's a backlog of material for people to consider. So that's kind of where we are right now. But it's out there and it's getting into the right hands. We have an agent that has been helping us with that. And we'll keep our fingers crossed. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But I as I told you at the beginning, I keep goals and I'm persistent on things. And eventually the ooh shiny brings me back to that spot.
Ooh shiny. So. I love that. We're running out of time, which always blows me away. There's so many things I want to know about you. One of them is I've been reading a book about rituals that artists, scientists, famous and successful people do. To get them to the place of doing their work. Do you have any rituals or routines that you follow that get you into the mood, if you will?
Well, no rituals per se. I do my best writing at night. I do put noise-canceling earphones on. And when I can't sleep, I'll sit down and start working. But rather than a ritual per se, it's an attitude that I think is more important for writers, which is to forgive yourself for those fallow times. And when you come back to it, you come back to it. And you know, some things will never get finished. But when you develop some momentum, stay on it and don't quit until it's polished and you walked around the sculpture many times and say, it works here, works at this angle, works here, and it's okay.
Gar LaSalle, I cannot thank you enough for joining us here on Real Talk today.
My pleasure, Susan. Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking with author Gar LaSalle, and I recommend his book, Widow Walk, which is the beginning of a five-part saga of the United States, really, in the mid to late 19th century. Yeah. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan McCabe, your host.
That was fun.